Welcome back to Word of the Witnesses, our 12 Monkeys rewatch podcast. As a reminder, this is a rewatch podcast, which means we've seen the entire series and hopefully you have too, because we will spoil it from the end to the beginning. We have a very special episode because today Beep and Cece are joined by Mr. Terry Metalis to discuss his amazing finale, episode 213, Memory of Tomorrow. A quick note for you guys, in the middle of this, around minutes 43 to 60, there is a treatise on the importance of endings that specifically surrounds Game of Thrones. If that's a show you either don't watch or don't want to be spoiled on, please go ahead and skip that section. And without further ado, here's our conversation with Terry.
All right, Terry, welcome back.
Hi. I'm happy to be here on a Sunday morning. Happy Memorial Day. Or tomorrow's Memorial Day, I suppose. But and for you listening, you've already had your Memorial Day, which is perfect for a time travel show.
You just finished watching, right, the episode?
Yeah, I woke up, poured myself some espresso and watched it. I haven't watched it in years. I think I've watched like parts, but yeah, watching it all the way through was really weird, especially out of context, because so much of that episode relies on the momentum of 11 and 12, mm-hmm. you know, right before it. So just like dropping in, you're like, whoa, man, it moves very fast. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And you wrote this episode. How did you – can you tell us a little bit, if you can remember back, you are – because in some ways this episode is wrapping up a lot of what you've been building for two seasons and then kind of breaking it all open for the rest of the story. Yeah. So when you were approaching writing it, what were your goals sort of not only plot mythology-wise but character-wise?
Well – you know, it was a big deal to have Cassie and Cole openly in a relationship and doing this full romance. That was really scary to me because, you know, that's where TV can go to die. When two characters, you know, you've been hoping, you know, doing the will they, won't they thing with, suddenly get together, is the tension gone? And what is that chemistry going to be? Pardon me. And so it was, you know, we were nervous because you and I mean, you only get, you know, a little bit of a glimpse of it. But what was so great about how it played out was, you know, I remember I was like, well, Christmas played a major part of the movie. So I was like, I know I want that to be a thing. Plus there's like you, whether you're, you know, celebrate Christmas or not, the holidays in general have this warmer feeling. There's like there's an amped emotion of closeness to people around you. So it felt like a good place to drop in and see this new Cole and Cassie. And then maybe you would bring some of your own, you know, holiday emotions into it, you know, along the way. It worked out pretty good. And I think the main thing was how great Aaron and Amanda are. The stuff in the house where they're opening up their Christmas presents, we block shot all that. So that means the love scene, the blood wash away in the sink stuff, the Christmas stuff. There's a dance that we've cut to a couple times that's in the Blu-ray. Deleted scenes. It's he comes home and they dance in the living room and kiss. All that stuff was shot at the very end of season two. Was the last thing we did. So it was nice because we were, and we've talked about this before. I think Aaron has mentioned it was like making this little indie movie where it was just Amanda, Aaron, and me trying to figure out how to make this good. And they have such a natural chemistry. I was like, even this morning when he opens up the Christmas present and it's the razor and he just says no, her laugh is so genuinely Amanda. It's you're seeing the best of them as well on screen. So it was anyway, so that was really the goal of the script, is really make you invest in these two and then tear them apart again.
Yeah, you kind of, you crank up the angst big time in this one. It's another, yeah. We're going to give you everything you want, and then we're going to strip it all away in one episode. Do you have any, I mean, I know we talked a little bit about this last week, but when you go back on rewatch and, you know, now we know that we're watching what is, you know, essentially in the story, the happiest time in these two characters' lives. Mm. And how that's going to also be looked back with loss and thinking about what Cassie's thinking about, you know, at the end, when she's contemplating whether, you know, like ending the world to get back to this place. Did you have sort of any thoughts or like as you guys were talking about in the writer's room going back to this moment? Because now it really, at least for me, it hits me in a different way.
You mean, did we have talks during seasons 3 and 4 about going back to these moments
or just as you're watching it play out now?
Well, for sure. I mean, you know, it's when you're part of this process, it's hard not to see, what you view as the warts, you know, or the woulda, coulda, shoulda, you know, I think, ideally, if you knew the show had 6 seasons, you know, it's funny when you listen to your podcast, you're like, why isn't 11, you know, 2-11 a finale, or why isn't 2-12 a finale? And they all very well could have been. They all, you know, you could have done an entire season, you know, ended season 2 at 2-11 and then started season 3 on their way to Titan and then told the story of Cassie and Cole in their year trying to find the primary, and then them back in time and presuming it's over. There's hundreds of stories that we talked about in the room. You could have done that, but we, you know, you're not sure. There's no guarantee you're coming back for season 3. So, you know, we're just like, let's go for it. Let's tell the story. And there, it's, you had to get to, I think, a point at the end of season 2 where you had to reveal who the witness was. I think to hold it off any longer probably would have felt like a groaner. You could have done it, especially when I look at things, you know, how they rush through things now on other shows. but I think we could have, it would have been nice to see more of them, be them, over the course, but so that you could feel it more at the end when Cassie's up there in the Tower of Titan, if that makes sense.
I think though that reveal is brilliant in the sense that it's a lie, in a way, you know.
Which reveal? Oh, well,
the witnesses.
Or the witnesses? Yeah. Yeah. Well, they all believe it.
Sure. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's why it's so compelling, you know, because it kind of launches us off in an entirely different storyline. And when you see all the pieces really fit back together, it was certainly a piece, but we were not seeing it and they were not seeing it correctly.
Right.
So when you all filmed this finale, because this, it's a question, like, for example, when fans go back and listen to like Talking Monkeys, you all, when you're talking about this episode, it's hard. Like, did you, at this point, when you guys, when this episode aired, were you still thinking Ethan was the witness, or were the wheels already turning? Now it's actually Olivia.
The wheels were already turning. I had told, she didn't take it in. I remember on one of the last days we were shooting season 2, I was like, oh, you know, it's going to be Olivia. I said to her, and she was like, oh yeah, yeah. And
to Allison,
and okay. she's spoken about that before. She didn't really take it in until she got the scripts in season 4 that she was really kind of blown away. Well, she's like, wait, no, I'm like, yeah, I've said this to you a bunch of times. She's like, no, I know, but it was like, it was always me. I'm like, yeah, there's kind of a, came to it from, and we definitely explored hours of conversation of many different ways. One, we explored Sam being the witness. Mm. We explored it quite a bit and what that would mean. If Ramsey had died at the end of season 2, and the last thing Ramsey had said was, you know, please take care of my boy, save my boy. And then now it's, you know, now the boy is the witness. What do you do? That was an early thought on it. Although emotionally, we always deeply considered it should be Cassie and Cole's kid. But you also, you start to police yourself and ask yourself, is that cheesy? Do people just see that coming a mile away? So you have to explore everything. So when I say mathematically, you ask yourself, well, you're probably roughly around the midpoint now, right? Mm-hmm. What do you want to see? Do you want to see a show in which parents have to go kill their kid? Like, it's definitely the story you want to, you know, there's good drama there, but it's like, ugh. You know, is that ultimately where you want to end up?
Yeah, is that your end game?
So it becomes this redemption story no matter what. And then, you know, how do you do a redemption story that's not – you want to do the good version of Anakin Skywalker, you know? And, you know, that's scary too because it has not been done well. So that was kind of the thing. I mean, there was many different ways that season 3 could have started. Different ways 2163, you know, at one point I remember exploring it. It was like a Metropolis. It was like Blade Runner. It was like prosperous. Like it was like they had, everything was great or not great, but like under, you know, a tight control of the witness, but it was like, imagine 12 Monkeys City that was like Blade Runner being run by the witness. So, but then you're like, we're not going to be able to produce that. We don't have the budget of Altered Carbon. We have the budget of, you know, Costco. Honestly, yeah, exactly. So, but there, like, we definitely went there and talked about it. You know, but it always sort of became, you're going to have to save your son. And so mathematically it meant that the witness had to be somebody else. And then the argument became, well, was it always somebody else or do we change time? And I just thought it was more emotional that it was always Olivia for everybody. That was more emotional for her to not know that this thing that she hated was her. Mm-hmm. I thought it was more emotional for Ethan to not know. This little boy's told he's going to be this demon, but he doesn't feel like he's a demon.
And doesn't want to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. But do you have any say or not?
Right.
Yeah.
It was funny. My therapist started watching the show. So there's like these portions of my therapy sessions, which I'm happy to admit
that I go to. Thank you so much for saying that out loud. So
she's like, I need to understand. So was it always Ethan? Was it always Olivia? So it's probably really unhealthy to talk about your show. But she's like, you know, coming back with all sorts of windows into my soul.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, so what is the deal with your mother and father?
In there?
Right. Yeah. We need to talk about this. Yeah.
Well, so just to key off really quickly about it always being Olivia. So we have spent a lot of time this season because you really have to reframe, you know, I get – and of course, correct me if I'm wrong, sort of there are certain things, you know, as we learn in season 4 that Olivia had to do to ensure her own creation, right? So like when we're watching this season and we see Kirshner at the microscope, we now know what happened. But there are a lot of moments, particularly in season 2, whether it's the writing on the wall, you know, prepare Cassie, prepare her, and then she's sending herself to more T visions, or she's, you know, manipulating the pallid man into thinking he's the one in charge, or the visions of Titan and luring them. So how, when you guys had to sit down to write season 3 and 4, how did you all frame what season of 4 Olivia was doing this season, if that makes sense? Why was she luring them, whether it was...
Well, she had to end up where she was, right? Mm-hmm. So she ended up in a place where she learned, she takes over Titan kills Ethan and learns, oh, wait, it's up to me. It was always me. Then she has to make sure she gets up. She gets to that exact same place. And, you know, the amazing part of a loop is, well, it's kind of spelled out for you because it already happened. Yeah. So I know that I have to do this. And the witness is very manipulative. Like, you don't really know why. I love that it's like there's something great about the witness being a woman masked and believed to be another man. Like, there's something so insidiously genius about that, too. So it kind of was perfect. We were adamant about, like, we needed to see Olivia do those things so it wasn't just retcon. And that was it. We just mapped it out. We knew we had 20 episodes and we just mapped it out, and, you know, very specifically. And did that.
It's incredible to frame her crisis of faith in light of, you know, it, her faith technically being in herself.
Right.
Such a, when you look back at that and you frame it, you know, in our world and how the way that people lose faith in themselves as much as they do higher powers, but to find out she is the higher power, it's just so twisted.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great territory that you can't really do on a traditional show. It's what makes the show unique.
Before we jump in, sort of hitting some of the big scenes, hopefully if you have time in this episode, just since this is sort of, in some ways, it almost seems like these last two episodes really kind of run together.
Well, I think 11 runs into it too.
Yeah.
It's like
a three-part finale.
Yeah.
The ideas and the sort of these themes of let's take the first one too, A Memory of Tomorrow, right? It's the title of the episode. This is sort of a concept of deja vu, or all of the different ways it manifests itself in the story. Were you inspired by any other works or research, other things that you all had read that kind of fed this idea?
You're asking about the Alice in Wonderland?
Well, a lot. I mean, you've got a lot of little Easter eggs, whether it's the caretaker music that is in.
Right. Yeah, you brought that up the last thing. So, not really, but kind of. Meaning, so for like the caretaker, we had this brilliant director named Chris Byrne, who directs, well, he's directed all of seasons one and two of the most beautiful stuff in American Gods, which, if you've, you know, or in Hannibal, he's just this amazing visual artist. And early in season two, I hired him to help me, it's a very specific, and in season one as well, he helped out with a lot of the Red Tea stuff. It was like, this needs to be surreal. It needs to be classy. It needs to be weird and dreamlike. And some of the other directors were just not getting that aesthetic. So he ended up making this 12 Monkeys website, which was all about how to make the Red Forest. And he was going to make a virtual Red Forest that we were going to use in the show. And on the website, when you went to the front page, he had the caretaker music playing. And I was like, he gets exactly what this is. It stuck with me, and I was like, I want to use that. It's so cool and weird and dreamlike that I just wrote it into 12 and 13, the weird music. And then we knew we had to pay it off as this weird song in the 20s that the kid was listening to on the phonograph and in Titan. So that's where that came from. So that was Chris being aware of that artist, knowing what he was trying to do and say about time in the past and applying it to 12 Monkeys. And then Memory of Tomorrow, I guess it probably did come from Alice in Wonderland, but I can't remember how and who became a thing. But sure, I mean, it seems like that was definitely influenced to us.
I'm sitting over here kicking myself for not realizing the visual parallels with Hannibal right now.
Yeah.
With the Red Forest. Because Hannibal, like, visually just makes me so happy.
Well,
but thinking about, like, the raindrops.
Sounds like you could use some therapy, too.
Finale. And I mean, no one is denying that, Terry. yeah, but, like, even the raindrops and stuff and just, like, the little details that they pay attention to in that. That's.
Yeah, it was beautifully shot.
I'm kicking myself. I'm telling you. Love it.
Yeah, it's beautifully shot. Yeah.
So the other, I mean, just since this episode, we have, you know, just taking from Alice in Wonderland, if we could jump to talking about Lillian, because she's actually a character that quotes Alice in Wonderland in this story. Yes. Let me just put a pin in. I don't want to jump ahead because the first time we see her is, you know, we go from these idyllic Christmas, you're giving fans everything that they ever wanted. And then we start to see, is it that time is breaking down? Is it because Lillian can communicate with Cole because he's a djinn? But things start to freeze and we see her standing in the street and then he goes to see her. Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, I've heard before in other interviews, like, how fun it is to let Madeline Stowe get to play the crazy this time in the story after having to be the straight woman in the film. But now that we've met so many other primaries, how did you all think about how Lillian fits into sort of this, like, the pantheon of primaries? Because she kind of seems like the Yoda or one of the Yodas of primaries.
I think she's a Markridge. She is on the Jennifer line. She's in the family. Wow. Yeah. We had it in the script, but it felt a little tiny town. So I took it out. She was, like, I believe we worked it out. Like, 'cause she killed her family. Eventually we had figured out that she would escape the asylum and have another child. But, she was a Markridge. So she was part of the whole Jennifer Goinsy part of it all. And then, you know, it was about time collapsing and Cole and her being, you know, we wanted her to be like the Obi-Wan Kenobi of primaries, like someone who really was much older, much more in tune with it. It's funny when you watch the episode, man, the episode just zooms along. It feels like it's like a 90-minute episode packed into 43 minutes. And I wish we had time to breathe more. But that was the idea, that she would be his guide. So she had to be one of the greatest of them all.
Wow, and she's related to Jennifer. That is so cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could chew on that for a hot minute.
Sorry. So she, but, you know, she's more knowledgeable. On the other hand, we've met some crazy primaries, right? Like, we met Kyle Slade. Mm-hmm. She murdered her family.
Yeah, she's kind of nuts.
So it's, I mean, I guess we all deal with sort of the idea of our family being ripped apart by the Red Forest in different ways. But she seems, on the one hand, seeing that puzzle from above, on the other hand, particularly frightening. So one thing I noticed, and maybe this wasn't intentional, but, you know, she says, go down the rabbit hole, drink me. It's like an, you know, explicit reference to Alice in Wonderland. The vision. So when Cole actually does drink the tea and is going through the hallway, almost as a representation of traveling through the time stream through his consciousness, it reminds me of the Hall of Doorways in Alice in Wonderland after she finishes the tea party.
Interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of art, you know, of that moment, and it just hit me on I was like, wow, really? So I don't know if that was happy accident or not, but
I think some of that is happy accident, but also just all of the artists involved in the show, you know, weaving that sort of aesthetic into it. So yeah, it makes sense that would be a part of it.
If we can turn to that whole when Cole takes that trip.
Yeah, hold on a second. I got to pause you because I looked at I'm just on my Gmail right now. I was like, I wanted to confirm that it was Lily and Markridge. And yeah, I'm looking at originally they wanted to even bill it in IMDb as Lily and Markridge. I was like, no, let's just leave it a little bit just to keep it open. But then Lily and Markridge came up as a possible 405 story. I'm in the like the writer's room notes now. I'm sorry, I'm deep diving while you're talking.
Oh, no, I love it.
And it says 405 Lillian story. It says this is the writers talking. I think I was up on set. What's weird about these, and since someone should publish these, I mean, basically everything that was ever said in the writer's room, we had this writer's assistant who wrote it like there were a court stenographer. Like it is everything, like it tells you who said what question was said, and there's literally, I don't know, 2,000 pages of this, right? But this is Kristen, and she's like, there's a story to be told in episode 5, 405, involving Jennifer in an asylum in 1963, and maybe Lillian is there. We get Madeline back, who wanted to come back on the show. This would be an episode where we do Don't Drink the Red Tea. To do this, there's a promise of Anne's. Anyway, we definitely went down the rabbit hole, bringing her back and pairing her up with Jennifer. There you go.
That would have been really cool. Yeah. those notes would be so fun. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'll just forward a bunch to you guys, and you guys could do a podcast on. You will not believe the shit we read.
Also, we know. We know people that make websites.
Right.
Like me. Right. Who could, spearhead.
So many of the, like, there's, I mean, hold on a sec. Let me just pull up that page again and tell you how many pages that was. This is 10 pages of notes. A daily amount of notes came with a table of contents. So like they would write up the notes and then, but the first page of the notes would be the table of contents as to where. So like this was for this episode was Jennifer's red tea trip. One, Elliot Jones, the 6-day marriage, reasons Jones left Raritan. Page 2. What is Elliot's main motivation, ego, ambition? Page 4. What is Hannah's point of view? Page 5. Hannah knows Jones is dying. Page 6. So it's like, these are all like, yeah, they're pretty fun.
Oh, it's so great.
Also, I'm not sure we know any nerds who really like to read.
Right. I would be careful annotating it first.
It's starting to be like that one time in band camp. It's just like, can only go back, I mean, for a 4-year show. Anyway, go ahead. Okay, so let's move forward. Yeah.
Yeah, so we've got that amazing, it's a new form of time travel that we haven't seen on the show before, right? Cole, so is it, the correct way to frame it, Cole is tapping into the time stream using the tea to travel through his own subconscious. Like, yes. He can only go through his own consciousness.
Yeah, his own timeline, yes.
And
before he's been before.
As opposed to season 4, Olivia using the time stream, and she can jump into other people's minds, including her own.
Right. Well, she's the witness. She's way more. She's all amped up and using Titan, so she has way more power. And she's kind of lurking in that zone. Because we needed that to be a limitation, that you couldn't just do this whenever you wanted. And in 301, you hear about, I think Hannah says to him, you know, I can hear you at night, you know, when you drink the red tea, trying to find Cassie. We can hear the screaming. We went down the road of, and if we had more time, we would have seen that it's not working. Remember at top of 301 is Cole's just scouring 2163 trying to get to Cassie. But there was also quite a big storyline where he was drinking the red tea at night. He wasn't sleeping. Aaron Stanford wanted to play him with red stained teeth in 301 because he was drinking so much of it. But I felt like that would be terrifying to look at for an hour and ruin his handsome face. But we had to go down the road of making sure that made sense, that this wasn't an option for you, you know?
Right, because I mean, if you're Cole at the end of this episode, you're going to torture yourself over the choices you made, right? To go after Ramsay. So that, right. Yeah. What is really cool now in Rewatch is it's the two Jens facing off in that corridor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right. Good point.
Yeah. So is there, you guys kind of picked out some key Cole moments. And it's really fun that Jennifer remembers what, right? As a primary, she can remember that he told her, I'm always going to call you Otter.
Right.
Was there any thinking that went into picking those particular moments for Cole's journey as the big moments for him that he would be, right? Because you guys kind of, it's Cassie, it's Ramsay, it's the first time he meets Jennifer.
Well, you want it to be a love letter to 12 Monkeys, to what you had seen before, that because we weren't entirely sure if we were going to come back. So it was a nice way to kind of go back and look at the series and how far they've come. So that was one of the, you know, and then it was like picking Jennifer. I think he had, at one point he had jumped into himself, you know, in the night room when he's looking at the corpse and he kind of grabs his head and you're like, oh, is that because he's having a paradox?
Mm-hmm.
That was the moment he jumped into and that's why he was doing that. I forget why we didn't do that. I mean, I think maybe because it said it wasn't him. And we wanted to keep that out there a little bit longer. So yeah, there was a bunch of reasons to go look at those particular scenes.
Got it. So then they're able to undo, they get their redo. They're back in 2044. Everyone's point of view is crazy. If you think about these three people talking in a room, you've got Jones, Cole, Cassie. Cole at that point is remembering everything for 2 years. For Cassie at that moment, that it's only 1 year of their mission in 1957. And then you've got Jones, who had this amazing, like, cigarette hanging out of her mouth with her dog and firing a shotgun at Scavs. Right. it's also the first time we hear her call someone that she calls the dog a little shit, which is going to be a big clue.
Right.
Yeah. But it's some great Jones getting to be kind of a badass. And that montage. And so you're bringing all these characters back together. Everybody's got different perspectives. I think there's even a deleted scene where Cassie's asking Cole what happened first time you did it. So yeah. How did you approach sort of like wringing out the maximum amount of angst there? And there is that scene that got cut. But it's just a lot of crashing together of a lot of different points.
Yeah, I mean, I think we only cut it for time. I mean, we would have gladly have kept that scene happily. It was just, do we have the runtime for it? It's a lot less calculated than you might think. It was more about organically telling that. And tracking Cassie's point of view, I think, is super important, you know, mm-hmm. like her, what does she remember? What does she not remember? You know?
Yeah. Can we go to Jennifer's all time classic leadership speech moment? So they decide they're going to go and try and save them, which is really interesting given that Lillian warned Cole, you got to let your brother go.
Right.
And saying that this loop must be broken. And he kind of, you know, loyal to a fall, ignores that. That sets up Jennifer's. To me, this is one of my favorite classic Jennifer pop culture giving the speech, right? Playing a role, right? Several roles.
Right.
So did you wrote that scene and sort of like, how did that come about?
Yeah, I just, I don't know. We needed to give Jennifer a big moment because she was so absent in the finale that she needed something fantastic, one great Jennifer scene that, and I just remember, I think we said, well, it's a she gives a speech, a Jennifer-esque speech. I'm like, well, wouldn't it be great if, you mashed up all those speeches, Independence Day and Braveheart and Lord of the Rings. It was, I think it was much longer at one point. There was like two others in there as well. So yeah, it was just, it was just that to shine a light on the speech trope. And then have it fail, which I quite like too, is that they kind of all just walk away. I love Barbara going, "What is happening?"
Yep. I love that, like, the Henry V St. Crispin's Day speech doesn't work, but Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure does.
Right.
Like, that's what carries the day. Yeah.
Right.
She also, every time Jennifer is playing that role or is using, you know, words that are not her own or being authentic, it always just comes back to smack her in the face. And it never works. The fortune cookie stuff doesn't work. The pop culture stuff doesn't work. Like, her journey is so cool of, like, learning that it's your empathy and your character and, you know, who you are that's going to get you through this and not, like, all of these, like, niceties and cliches.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of I'm currently in the CBS MacGyver writer's room, which is a place I'd never thought I'd find myself. It's mostly a staff that I inherited. But I brought Travis Fickett, who you know, of course, from 12 Monkeys History, onto the show. And we will very often do a whole bunch of pop culture references and nobody gets it in that room. We're like, really, guys?
Aww,
really? Boba Fett? You guys don't know Boba Fett? Come on.
What?
Yeah.
It's well, nerds.
It's a different, well, they're nerds. They're just different kinds of nerds. Right. So, but it is funny. We're Jennifering it quite a bit.
I love that.
Just goinsing it up in there. Huh?
So we
too many snacks all going across the all goins.
If we could go and talk about Titan, because. Yes. Titan. We Titan. Actually. Well, no, Titan. don't. No, damn it! Now you're gonna make me do that. It is one. I think it's one of the most true, like, original. How did they come up with this idea? Crazy sci-fi parts of this show.
Yeah.
How did you guys? It's a time traveling city. If do you remember sort of what the genesis of that was?
Well, it wasn't always a time travel city. It was just. It was a place that they were going to be, lured into to go to, and the shit was going to hit the fan. And I think at one point early on, Chris Monfett, pitched, he's like, well, what if as they're going into the city, there's like a ring around the city that they cross. And then you come to realize that ring is designed to transport the city through time. And I was like, remember that landing? Be like, I don't know how you could transport the city. Like, that just seemed like such a big idea. But then, you know, it was like a few episodes later, I was like, you know what? That's exactly what it needs to be. And then I'm like, well, then I was like, what if Elliot Jones brought it in to construct it? And, you know, there are just these on top of these towers are you see Jones's machine. You see, you know, you can't see them because they're so high in the darkness. But once they turn on, you realize, oh, and then they all it just became this organic writer's room thing. And then once we knew that, we knew, you know, that's why when Hannah in 12 goes to scout ahead, she's like, I scouted. It wasn't fucking there because it hadn't splintered there yet. Mm-hmm. And so. It just became, this cool thing. And then once we had successfully shot that and it became such a big part of this, of the finale of that thing powering up, we knew it just had to stay a part of the show forever because it was so cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do the Aramaic symbols stand for anything in particular on the floor? And we also see them when Olivia drinks the tea at Monkey Mansion.
Yeah, they are the numbers of a clock. It's like an altered ancient Aramaic, I think, probably goes back to that one Middle Ages primary, what's his name, from 408?
Oh, Andrews? 407.
Yeah, Andrews. Yeah. I think it goes back to his group as well. But yeah, they're just sort of, you know, they're the army of time, and it's basically a clock.
Got it.
I do remember, because they're Aramaic, they're also kind of Hebrew. And I remember when we screened this particular finale in a movie theater, rather than show the executives, just because normally you send them a link on a shitty streaming site, I actually got a movie theater on the Universal Studios lot and showed it to them. I was like, you guys come, we're going to show you 12 and 13. We made popcorn for them, and it looked great, by the way. I remember I was like, it went over. There were like no notes. That's the way to do it. And then afterwards, one of the execs walked up to me. He's like, so was the witness a Jew? I was like, what? No. I don't. I mean, maybe. I don't know. I guess. Do you want him to be? I don't know where that was going. But he was Jewish, and he's like, he recognized the symbols. So, but yeah.
Got it. Oh, got it. we have the big Cassie remembering not every caterpillar becomes a butterfly. And this phrase stretching all the way becomes like the expression itself comes to mean so many different things. And it's going to come back at the beginning of season three. But I know that there's a scientific explanation, right, with the injections. Mm-hmm. But we're also going to end this show with characters remembering who they loved, who they cared about, right, in the final epilogue. So now when you watch it, it does seem sort of like thematically like a big moment for the show that it's going to keep coming back to. Do you have any thoughts just sort of, you return to it a lot in some of the final images of the show?
I forget everything that's happened before it, in a weird way is its own trope that kind of drives me a little crazy. Mm-hmm. I also don't like the idea of, and it's weird because I've heard this about the series finale is that, they're like, oh, so do they only remember little bits? I'm like, no, they clearly remember everything. If you're watching that, and she's like, we saved 7 billion people. Like, she knows all of it. I mean, I think some of it's foggy because of what happened in time being reset. But I think certainly by the time Cole shows up and they have one conversation, it's all back. You know what I mean? I don't love the idea of what, but I did like playing with that. You think time has been undone in such a way that maybe a less intelligent human wouldn't remember, you know, but Cassie's like, no, it meant so much. And it kind of ties into the whole theme, I guess, with Lillian and then Cassie's statement in the message at the end, which is that, you know, death can be undone, but love can't. So love cannot. And that it, you know, there's something more going on, you know. Love is the fifth element, guys. What are you going to do?
I mean, I have to say it's TV's been a little desolate lately. And so it's – I think, we talk a lot on the podcast about how that theme, that it matters. It matters what people do for one another. And I don't mean to sound cheesy. I just – it is hopeful in a way without being – you can be realistic and still hopeful, if that makes sense. You know.
So what did you guys think of Game of Thrones?
I don't know how much time you have, Terry, this morning.
Well, go on. Let's talk about it.
All right.
We don't need to talk about fucking 12 monkeys.
Beef, do you want to go first? You want me to go first?
About Game of Thrones?
I
thought that was a joke.
As I'm processing it, and I read all the books, and I, you know, obsessed. So one of my favorite stories of all time. So I recognize that brings with it a lot of, like, emotion, expectations, right? And I'm not somebody who, even though
you've read all of them?
I read all of them, yeah.
Those last two are rough. Those are hard.
Yep. I mean, I can like track like when I had a newborn and what book came out, right? Because I was reading at like 3 a.m.
No, I read, it was one of the, when I first moved to LA, it was the first book, Game of Thrones was, and at the time you could, they hadn't blown up yet and you could, remember AOL Instant Messenger?
Yes. Mm-hmm. AIM.
You could just IM George R. R. Martin all day long.
Sure.
Yeah. I met him. He was at, he would sign at this, I think it was called Dark, an amazing bookstore in Sherman Oaks, which I forget what it was called, but it was dedicated only to science fiction. And he was there all the time signing. And he'd give you his email address and you can email him and IM him. And I have somewhere printed out like some 2 day long marathon where I was like, I know who Jon Snow's mother is, and like way back from just reading that book. And but that, yeah, that's how far back it goes for me.
That's crazy. So, yeah. Though he was like doing, you know, Twitter, like the direct access to writers, producers.
Yeah, they don't, he loved it.
Obviously
he
loved have it. To look at it, but like he was having his own little social media thing
going. Yeah, and it was way before even Storm of Swords had come out. It was like, I think only the first book in Feast for Crows was just coming out. And it was starting, they were starting to become they were never really a huge phenomenon until HBO started airing them. But yeah, those were, yeah. That first book is one of the great books of all time.
Yeah. So my layers of disappointment are, I think, ultimately like threefold. I love like taking something that's fantasy and like freaking dragons and knights and magic and melt and like combining that with what were really sophisticated political themes was basically like my most happiest place for a story, like all of the things that I love. And so at the end, I can't really tell. It's so muddled what it was trying to say politically. And or it is such a pessimistic worldview, but I'm not sure it realizes it's a, at least the TV show realizes it's a pessimistic worldview, that I was like crushed from that part of that, the way that it unfolded. Obviously the character turns and plot stuff was so like, I just felt like what it was so fast that I was throwing objects in my room.
You're talking about Danny burning the city?
That in particular, yeah. And that's not because I can't see where you get there in an outline on paper, right? Like I'm not saying like, oh, I wish that hadn't happened. That's different than saying I don't understand how you got there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, frankly, I think there's an emotional piece of it. Like as a woman watching a fantasy story where women finally got to have equal roles to men, right? Like growing up, I never had stories where women were the ones riding the dragon, right? Or the ones, right? We had the big political battle at the end. I really think that the female characters got short shrift in this season. And then you see, right? Like they only had 22% of the lines. And then you start to be like, maybe that feeling is actually tied to some of the story choices they made and who's talking. And so that's my three layers of abject depression and disappointment with that season. How about you?
Me personally, I don't know why it was so rushed. It felt like the whole season could have been the Night King, and then if you wanted to do the next part of it, that should have been its own season. Mm-hmm. The story of the Mad Queen. The turn itself does not bother me. I kind of felt like she was always going there, and I felt like they had certainly given you glimpses of, I don't know. I thought Danny was kind of an asshole for a long time. When she burned the Tarleys, I was like that, and you knew for me, I was like, oh, that's where they're going with this. It was so ruthless and cruel, in that I felt like they had hinted that way, but it's undeniable that when you get to it here, you know, 90 minutes after the Night King, you're like, whoa, what? You're like whiplashed. It's a hard needle to thread. You know, so it needed 10 episodes to lead to that, you know, and I don't know why they had that option. Mm-hmm. I think they were all like, let's just get this done, or they didn't feel like there was enough to do in between there. So
I think it became obvious that they just wanted out. I mean, I can't prove that, obviously, but I just, you know, I just think that they were just done.
I don't know why. Why would you be done? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe there's some other story to this that we don't know. Or it was just a creative, you know, look, there's a different creative call. You know, I think.
They were offered, though. I mean, they've acknowledged, right? The creators have acknowledged that they were offered more episodes, more seasons. Like, HBO didn't want to end it. And they were just like, nah, we only need 13, like, first 7 and 8. Like, we're good.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why you do that.
Yeah, I thought her turn. I mean, I don't think it was. It was definitely out of nowhere in that episode. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was out of nowhere in general. I think I'm surprised that she started with the innocence. Yeah, I can much more see it. Like, even if it was in the exact same context as it happened, that she like would start with Cersei and then just get like rage, you know, and go to everybody. But the fact that it was just like, you know what? I think we should kill people. Like, I thought was weird. I think that Jaime and Cersei got shortchanged with just like a totally blasé ending.
Yeah, that was weird. I think that if they were going with the Mad Queen, right, they didn't make her crazy enough earlier. She was going through a lot. You know, granted that everyone she had on her journey had been killed, and you know, now this weird Jon Snow thing threatened her. Like, I get it, but like, it takes a certain level of insanity,
yeah,
to do that.
And they used grief, and that's not the same thing.
Yeah, it's not the same mm-hmm. thing. And her dad was legitimately mentally ill,
right?
Like, you know, so I felt like they needed to at least hint at that. Like, her dad, the Mad King, would talk to people who weren't there,
right?
Like, yeah,
you kind of needed to do that for a season.
Yeah, like, they showed some cruelty and impulsiveness, but I don't think they ever showed just like outright insanity.
I think that's the hard pill to swallow is Danny is just an asshole.
Exactly, and that's kind of like
here's the thing though. I think you can point to many other characters because this is like a feudal society, right? It's a bullshit system. Right. So like whether you're rooting for the Starks, and I felt like that's a theme that is even more in the books, right? Like, it doesn't matter whose flag you're flying under. It's still the common people who die and starve. Right. So like in essence, even if you're rooting for the Starks, like, what are you actually cheering for as an audience? But there are many characters who have all the way back to Ned Stark, to Robb Stark, who execute people for not being loyal, for not following orders. And so who the narrative chooses to call out for that and in some scenes portray that as, well, that's just the burden of leadership. And in other scenes portray it as, oh, that's a sign that she's crazy. Right. That's the part that I'm a little like, well, pick a lane.
Well, you know what the thing is? Yeah, but I mean, it's one thing to cut the head off of one deserter and then, I mean, the bottom line is children. And that was the thing that Ned Stark was like, we're not doing that, because he could have killed her as a child and none of this would have happened.
Oh, right. Yes. Remember? Yeah, absolutely the term. But I'm talking about like with the Tarleys. I'm like, well.
Oh, the Tarleys. Yeah, but that other guy, I don't know. I felt like, I don't know. The second I saw that, I was like, oh, she's going to be the Mad Queen. That's where they're going with this. Mm-hmm. Or at least you needed to believe that up until a certain moment, and then she makes the right choice, mm-hmm. and whatever that is, which could have been a way to go as well. But yeah,
I have two more like random qualms. Like, when you look at the Varys scene, like, exactly when did a dragon, like Dragonfire, become a sniper rifle? Because like everyone was standing within like 2 feet of that.
It didn't. That wasn't a good way to. No. I'm not sure. That felt like unnecessarily gratuitous. And they were all cool with that.
Yeah.
They were like, yeah, let's just nuke them. Yeah, but we'll all just stand here and watch.
Then also, Tyrion. They're like, Bran has the best story. Bran. I'm like, how many times has this person in this wheelchair said this season, he is not Brandon Stark.
Yeah, but that's the story you're selling.
Like, so weird.
What is, who is
he? I don't know.
Please be king, weird, stranger person who knows history, but lets it happen because you don't care. Like, I don't, oh, okay.
So the one thing I liked in that, I mean, I actually hate it and it made me want to throw stuff. But the one thing I liked was, but what bothers me is sometimes when I watch the audience reaction, I'm like, why am I the only person that feels this way? Like, when you watch Sam propose democracy, and you watch the room, like the council of, what was that video? The Council of Surviving Characters.
Yes.
When they laugh at the idea, that's a really powerful scene, right? Because it's like giving us a window into what is a room full of people who actually have power think about the rest of us, right? But when
you like that scene?
No. Meaning I like that it's provocative and it should make us uncomfortable. But it also leaves me hating all of those characters. And that's a really weird place to end the story where I'm like, God, you maybe not even like the Starks.
Yeah. Also, writers, like, read the room in 2019. Like, that's not...
Well, but I mean, like, right, but that's that. There's a piece in there that is a really interesting idea to explore politically. But I don't know if they actually get that or... if we're supposed to think about that, because then the way like Sansa being crowned and all of that is also framed as triumphant. And I'm like, I don't feel triumphant about that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like,
yeah, it's hard to, what I had hoped for is to be, have like spend the last half hour of that with tears in my eyes. And I didn't get a single one. And even the goodbye with the Starks were kind of weird, right? They were like, John's like, he's getting onto the boat to go up north or wherever he's going. And he's like, well, Arya, you could visit me and stuff. And she's like, I'm going to explore the world. Don't you know that's always been my arc? Because I wanted to be Captain Jack Sparrow. And I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. Okay, sure. Well, Bran, you're going to be king. So I guess I won't see you again. And then Sansa, I'm not allowed to. I don't know. And he's just goes back. I mean, I don't know. It just felt nothing.
I don't understand what they were trying to say by the isolation of those characters in the
pack. Yeah, I thought the pack survives together.
It's very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about the last times you've been on or Sean Tretto was on, and it sounds like you all were always so conscious of, back we were talking about whether it was Battlestar Galactica or Lost, the end, that the ending of the story is so important. And I feel like there's kind of a renewed or perhaps new conversation. Should that be an expectation we have of TV shows, you know, if creators have the freedom to end?
Well, I think if it's a serialized show, yeah. I think the pressure of that payoff I felt it. It was a gift for us when they said, you're going to get seasons 3 and 4 and be able to tell your whole story, right?
Yes.
So... and here's the runway to do it. Here's a tremendous amount of time. We had like 20 weeks in the writer's room, I think, even almost before we shot anything from season 3. So that was just an opportunity, you know, to be like, it's day one. Everybody get your coffees. Okay, let's talk about how this thing ends. And so I came in with a very rough take on it. And then along the way, you know, you find more things, but yeah, no, the pressure of that was really bad. And specifically because season 3, it was hard not to look at the end of season 3 with Ethan coming back and saving his parents. You're like, how are we going to do better than this? It's so emotional and feels like the end of the thing. And, so we were lucky, but yeah, I don't know how. I mean, I've got to think that there's also just not a lot of big serialized shows that have a mission statement that is what is going to happen. When I think of them, I think of Battlestar Galactica, which is we're going to get to Earth and save the population. I'm like, okay, well, there's an endpoint there. Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad is, you know, he's going to get caught. Mm-hmm. How is this going to end? Mm-hmm. Same thing with The Shield, you know, with Vic Mackey, which is, you know, again, I highly recommend, because if you all love Agent Gale, he's, you know, the number two.
Dutch.
Dutch, you know, is how, what is going, does Vic Mackey pay for his crimes? So you have these big questions, you have to answer them in Game of Thrones. That's like Star Wars, but bigger, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this epic end. It's a tough one to end on a good day, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Should be interesting to see if George writes those books. And I think it plays out. I mean, I think Danny is always going to be her father in some ways.
Agreed.
But maybe when you're in it, – it's interesting because when I think about some of those things – that they did, and if I thought about them in the context of a book, if I was in their heads, like if I was reading a Bran chapter mm-hmm. about the Night King coming for me, mm-hmm. I might connect to that story, right?
Yeah.
Whereas here, I'm like, what the fuck is he doing? He's just hanging out in the courtyard, and the guy showing up, and,
yeah.
and then Arya's
a
superhero.
Oh, you mean when he
warns
out for half the episode, and we have no idea why?
Yeah, he's like, I'm going to just go do some bird things.
I think I said later, I was like, he was just picking out a new throne from Target. Like,
right.
He's like online shopping. I mean, what is he doing?
I don't know. Is he leading the night? Did the Night King see the birds and it led him? I forget. I have to watch it again. But so I think in the context of a book, maybe this would have worked better. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, or at least being more in Daenerys's head, because we actually weren't a lot this season, mm-mm. which I think.
No, it was like everyone else talking about her.
Right.
Right.
Which is interesting, yeah. right? Because in the books, you normally didn't have the point of view of the person in charge, but that's also because you didn't realize who the story was really about at the beginning. So,
by the way, all the 12 Monkey listeners that have been tuned into this podcast who don't watch this show are going to be like, what the hell?
We'll do timestamps. So,
yeah.
Terry,
spoiler alerts.
Terry, do you have a few minutes just to answer some?
I have as much as you want. Keep
okay,
going.
So before we ask you some of our lingering big picture season 2 questions, we got to talk about, since this is a show that nails its end game and the questions that it raises, one of the biggest WTF moments is the mother scene.
Yeah.
At the end of this episode.
Yep.
What were your thoughts sort of about how you wanted to end on that note? And the Pallid Man is like at peak creepy. And it's like one of my favorite TV moments of all time. So what were you? You wrote it. So tell
me. Yeah, no, it just needed to be make you feel icky. And then we had to shoot it. You know, we shot it in this. Actually, the asylum, Lillian's asylum, is the same location as that theater, that weird theater with all the people. It's called the Scottish Rite, and it's in Hamilton. It's in Handmaid's Tale all the time, that location. And that theater, too, was in Handmaid's Tale. It just had to be weird and perfect. And you know, I think it needed one last Who Is the Witness fake out. Because I think in 12, you're certainly wondering if it's Cole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're watching it right, you know, and he's at the house and there's, you know, and you've been following the stories, like, is Cole the witness? Then I think you get to this and you're like, who is this person in the scarlet robes? And then you're like, oh, that's the Pallid Man. Like, that was the gist of like what you were supposed to feel when you read it. It's like he pulls the hood back. It's like, oh no, don't tell me it was him. Right. And then he's like, no, it's not me. And then you're like, what is going on? And I think some people, you know, there's this thing, and this goes into talking about endings, is some writers hate if the audience can get ahead of what you're doing. And certainly if you watch 212 and you watch them have sex, you're like, oh, the witness is their, you could say the witness is their kid. You could see that coming. I don't think that's bad if you do it well,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. because I think the writer, most writers have an instinct of, well, if they see it coming and then that's what I give them, then they're disappointed. Well, not necessarily. Sometimes they're like, I knew it. That's great. That's still a cool twist. And I think sometimes that happens, like you could see that happen in other movies and shows. You're like, oh, they were worried that the more satisfying answer was something that the audience could see coming, so they didn't go there.
Yeah, but also you guys kind of twisted it too, though, with, you know, when you undid it, we just assumed that Cassie was no longer pregnant. So then what happens?
Right,
you know,
exactly,
and it's like, yeah. Wait, oh, twist again. Like yeah. You said, I mean, you were telling a story and the story made sense. And there are twists where it's like the audience figures it out and they're like, oh my God, if they do that, it's going to be so dumb. And then there are ones where it's like, yes, let's figure out how they're going to get there. And I kind of think it has to do with the groundwork you've laid up to that point, whether people think it would be a good twist or a bad twist. And it's not whether they figured it out or not. It's just whether or not it connects to the story.
Right, right.
I'd rather it make sense than be a surprise.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think you can sometimes have twists like this one and you look back and you're like, oh, it totally makes sense, right? But I'd rather have had figured it out and then have that I knew it moment than have it be a surprise just for the sake of being a surprise. And then you sit there and you're like, but that doesn't even make sense.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Which happens quite a bit these days.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. And it was just a great cliffhanger, mm-hmm. Was to separate the two. And that they've admitted that they love each other. They have had this relationship and now you tear them apart and you have to wait, I don't know, what was it, a year and a half for it to come back?
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know if we were coming back. So it kind of, you got the sense with Cole getting into the machine and going to 2163 that if we were canceled at that moment, maybe he got there and saved her. But man, that would have sucked. That would have been not a good way to end the series. Could have, though. I mean, it could have been a powerful, like, oh, it was all about that all along, but it would have been weird.
Yeah. Now, you directed 301, and because of the way season 3 aired just over one weekend, there isn't as much out there just in terms of podcasts and discussion. So one question I had, because we'll be covering that next, obviously this is way before the television show Handmaid's Tale. Were you influenced at all writing or directing 301 by the book Handmaid's Tale? Because just some of the, like, imagery, costumey, like, right, women being a vessel, right? There's even a line that
I'd never read it, and that had not come out yet either,
right.
It was just, in fact, I think we were shooting it simultaneously, actually. I think some of our crew had just wrapped it up. The her look came from, of all places, some of the handmaids in actually of all things, Phantom Menace, or even Game of Thrones. I think some of Game of Thrones as well. We wanted to make, I mean, we were doing that same thing. She was being tended to by subservient, men and women. So we wanted this very specific look, and we wanted it to be, even though it was 2163, it had an old but new feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just something that we came up with. Yeah, Joyce did an amazing job with that wardrobe.
Yeah, yeah. It's just watching it now and thinking about the book and the whole, you know, they're basically treating Cassie like a vessel. There's definitely, yeah. So interesting. Okay. So do you have time for just some quick lingering season 2 questions?
Don't worry about time. Okay. You can do your thing. Go ahead.
All right. So we had both on the podcast and then also just sort of in the fandom questions about now when we watch Agent Gale in Fatherland in 1961, if he knew what was coming because of his interactions with Cassie and Cole in 1953. And I guess, Beep, help me articulate. Our read was that he does. He knows.
Yeah.
He remembers.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't think his loop changed.
Because he slips up. There's no loop that changed. That's sort of the question.
He always survived in Berlin.
Yes. Okay. Wait a minute. Let me think about this for a second. This, yeah, he always survives. Oh, no, they made the change. Hold on a second. Wait a minute. Now I'm getting confused because when he, in Berlin, he says to Cole, oh, right, you know what?
That, he's talking about. Time.
Oh, right, right, right. Okay, hold on a second. You're right. We've known each other a long time because he's talking about the season three, mm-hmm. 305
that
episode.
That hasn't happened yet.
Right.
For Cole.
Right.
Right.
Right. So I guess he has always, always done that. Although it's, though to be fair, the first time he shot, there's exit wounds. The second time he shot, you see him shot, there's no exit wounds. So they've made a change in that loop. So, yeah, I think there was a change made there.
So then he didn't know.
He did not know. He did not know. I don't know, guys. Something like that. Why? What's the point? No, because if he did know or didn't know, it doesn't matter. So a way to kind of look at the big cycle,
uh-huh.
right, is that there's all these tiny weird loops that change along the way. It's not like a tight circle, mm-hmm. right, that it's always in flux. It's mm-hmm. always kind of like some things are changing. Sometimes she went to Titan. Sometimes she didn't. Things played out weird. But the gist of the cycle always remains the same, that there's probably hundreds of different iterations of that cycle. That are changing, but little changes. For instance, Ramsey and the eye patch, and that Cassie dies. Well, you know, everybody's like, well, if Cassie dies and the witness isn't born and then the cycle doesn't happen, it's like, no, but because of this whole thing is so strong, that exists as a tiny little loop on the big loop, that remains in flux. Does that make sense?
Kind of because time is unraveling either way and it's got bigger things to worry about.
It's not really – it's stuck in the loop, but the loop can change along the way in little flashes of like a lightning storm. You know, it has all these little bits of storms that someone dies, but they're brought back. But the majority of the cycle always remains the same.
Got it. So,
yeah, because that was a question, like, how would Hannah be able to die in 212?
Right.
You know, for Cole to still be standing there.
How would Hannah be able to die in 212 for Cole to be able to, right? Because that mini loop always exists on the big loop. That the big change is pulling Cole out, but as long as there's a James Cole to make a change, there's a James Cole. You know what I mean? That's why he had to be erased. That's why he's the center of it all.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, obviously, though, from the strictly like linear standpoint, she just hadn't had him yet.
Right, but
in her timeline. So when she dies,
but there's a James Cole.
Right, a version of him already exists
in order to undo that. So therefore, that in that mini loop, it doesn't happen.
Okay. So when we're watching, totally. In Fatherland, when Agent Gale says to Cole, "I've known you a long time," he is referring to his experiences with them in 1953, which have happened for him, but not yet for Cole.
Yes.
Okay. And there is a version of the events, but maybe not the one we're watching in Fatherland, where he makes the decision to go to Berlin, even though he knows, and yes. he makes the adjustment.
Yes.
With the vest. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Another...
I mean, all these things we talked about in the room and drew up on giant boards and rationalized and argued about, but ultimately we were able to – the fact that Cole was the center of it all always was what made those tiny fluctuations make sense.
Got it. Okay. So our next kind of timey timeline type question is in Lullaby. Okay. When we see 2020 Jennifer and she's coaching Cole through that Groundhog Day loop over and over again, we had quite a discussion, I think, that ended up making our heads hurt trying to figure out, number one, does 2020 Jennifer know what Cole has to do?
Yes.
She knows. And does she know from her primary powers or because
she's been part of one of this loop? You're asking, does she know that Cole needs to go climb into the machine and erase himself?
No, but that's another good question.
I told you she knew that. The only thing I feel like she doesn't know is about the battle for Titan, because that doesn't change till 4-7.
Right.
Why? What do you mean? Why wouldn't she know that? She would know that.
But it's not, it doesn't exist yet. It's not part of a timeline.
It's her future. 4-0-7. Oh, that particular 4-0-7?
The Deacon thing.
4-0-7.
The knife.
Oh, well, she would know about that. No. She would. It depends on what moment. Yes. Okay. This goes into the fluctuating loops within the cycle.
Okay.
You know, so there are other versions, there are other graphic novels of seasons 1 through 4
right.
that play out similarly but different.
So in my mind, though, this particular on-screen 2020 Jennifer knows about everything except that, as far as big moments.
Yes.
Got it.
Boom, so, I got one.
Right, so she's...
Kind of. But I mean, it's like, it's it because... I mean, this is like trying to explain. We're not capable of knowing how this works because
it's all
bananas.
Right.
Anyway, it doesn't. Time travel will never make sense. Even when people are like, well, it's about quantum realities. I'm like, no, it's not, guys. Guys, nobody fucking knows. Nobody yeah. has any no. idea
right.
how that would work. Maybe
just try
sure,
to keep your own consistency. That's
right.
all yeah, that matters.
Totally.
I mean, there's the whole Avengers Endgame aspect of it, which I understand even less.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, fine. Like, it's a smart way from doing it. You can pretty much do whatever you want in that version. Yeah, anyway.
Okay, so it wasn't just that she was coaching him from her primary power. She actually knows what he has to do because – got it. Okay, so that was – so another – we have another Jennifer question. This one's about old Jennifer in Resurrection.
Okay.
And so when we have that chicken and egg scene and old Jennifer is saying, I chose to leave with my daughters and not go to Titan, but maybe you could be braver – our question was there another loop where that old Jennifer actually did make that choice not to go to Titan? Or is she simply having a conversation with her younger self as she remembers it played out, such as like a future asshole conversation?
And she's trying to get her to do the right thing?
Right.
Yes, I heard this on the podcast. I think the answer is yes.
Exactly.
you can that sort of choice is up to you. I like to think, and I couldn't tell you how it plays out right now, but I would be happy to break it out in a graphic novel, that there is a version of that loop in which she takes her daughters and tries to hide from the storms and it doesn't work, and therefore Ramsay and everybody else goes to Titan without the daughters, and that some version of this loop plays out that way. Just, and I like to think of that because I love to think of all the different 12 monkey stories that still could have been told. However, it could have been the other version that she is telling her what she needs to hear at that moment.
Got it. Graphic novels would be really cool. I want one just on the Keeper.
Yeah.
Like,
oh my God, the Keeper.
Can I write that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Were those all of our big timeline at the end of season 2 questions? I mean, the ones that are just really fun is it is just like breathtaking going back and watching, for example, all the Olivia and Pallid Man scenes.
Yeah.
And how it's what season 4 Olivia, just the ringer she's putting herself through.
Right.
You know,
she hates herself.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, that episode where she ends up at the bottom of the pool and you think, you know, and she's playing to the Pallid Man's ego and you stop and you're like, holy shit, that's season 4 Olivia who knows exactly what to say to him, right?
Right.
Like, it's so great. And I guess the other question was in Meltdown, when you have season 4 Olivia messing with the machine. And she knows the machine is going to misfire and send Sam to herself.
Yeah.
And then is it kind of a correct read? Like, she needs to go on that path because then she meets up with Ramsay again. And then that's what gets her inside of the facility and kind of unfolds everything that happens in season
three. Yeah, she knows. Yeah. I mean, she has the benefit of this has already happened. She also has the word of the witness, which probably had longitude and latitude for where Sam lands. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a ton of information she has. And at that point, it's all about managing it, right? I have to get here so that I can set this course right. So I'm going to go back and do all the things that I need to do to get there. So yeah.
Got it. I mean, Ramsay and Olivia are this really interesting pairing of sometimes their personal interests don't align with the teams that they're on, and then they end up working together in season three. It's kind of an interesting bookend to them in season one.
Yeah. Yeah, they're, you know, again, if we had more screen time, you would have seen a lot more of them back in the past and what their relationship was. And there was even a bit of a scene of sexy time written that we have somewhere out there where you saw that Ramsay and Olivia had a hot moment. There's all sorts of stuff.
Wow. That's some fanfic idea for folks.
Yeah, next time you get get Sean Tretta on and he can probably he will read you the scene.
Oh, that's God. So understandable, though, considering how isolated they've both been in their pursuits.
And I think that's exactly what it was. It was...
Is a whoopsie doodle.
No, it was more like, you know, yeah, human comfort and sexuality rather than, you know, a real true blue attraction.
Sure. And
for Olivia, it might have even been experimenting with can I feel anything with any human being?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because when we see her in season four, it sure doesn't seem that way, right?
Right.
She's seeking out that kind of human connection.
Yeah, my whole theory is that the only other human being she ever really was attracted to or felt anything for was Jones. That was the only person she felt a thing for. And that, again, more screen time, you probably would have seen more of that too.
That's going to make our listeners very happy, Terry.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole ship, Jones, and I'm not sure Jones would ever even consider going there, but maybe, like, you know, depending on where they were, you know, I think the stakes are so high in this show that you don't really know what you would be doing. But certainly for Olivia, I think Olivia had such reverence for Jones and who she was that she definitely was feeling that.
There's a cigarette lighting scene that's very sexy. So, yeah,
yeah.
It's coming up.
And we talked about that. We talked about that, how far do we go with Olivia's sexuality? And ultimately, while we were like, well, it's certainly not textbook straight in that way, it was hard to imagine her having any particular affinity for anything. So, except for Jones. So it wasn't that she was straight or gay or anything other than she was Jones sexual, like, or Olivia sexual. Like, if she was doing anything, it was with Olivia. Mm-hmm. She's a messed up, just, you know what I mean? She's kind of screwy.
Yeah. She's raised in a box. Like,
right.
Yeah. You don't come out of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And genetically messed with and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. So our one before we want to hear about your new projects, our one really, the show uses the very specific description of the House of Cedar and Pine, what the house is made of, over and over again. Was there any inspiration for that? Or was it just sort of, that's what someone came up with and then you stuck with it because that was the mantra?
Well, I always think it's like those, they're both very kind of aromatic, aren't they? Am I using the right word? They're mm-hmm. both like, you know, cedar, you can smell cedar and pine, and there's like a sort of a visceral thing that happens with both of them. Like, they're mm-hmm. kind of memory-like, those smells. They used to have a cedar box that I kept these toys in. And when I smell to this day, I'm like, it's like a memory if I smell it. Mm. So I think that was part of it. That was kind of, and it was just very specific, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Do you have any other sort of, we've come to the end of season two, launching into season three, things people should be kind of on the lookout as they rewatch for season three or?
I think it's the last, big Trevor Rabin score. Before Trevor went to go tour, you know, he is the guitarist of Yes. Mm-hmm. Trevor did like all these amazing other film scores, but this was the last time, because he was leaving, and Trevor and Paul. So it really has, especially in 12 and 13, there's this great riff that he uses for some of the big action stuff. That's as good as any big film that's out there. So that's always strikes me as there was a lot of work put into the score in those last two. It's where the show really starts to open up. And we're not just going back in time. We're going forward. We're going here. We're going there. It's a love story at, you know, full capacity now. 11, 12, and 13 I'm pretty proud of those. They were like one big 12 Monkeys movie. Just a way to look at them. Kind of got to watch all three at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So tell us about what you're working on now. Tell us about, we've got MacGyver on CBS.
Congratulations.
Yeah, that's.
Congrats.
Thanks. My day job at the moment is, CBS. I sold a bunch of broadcast pilots last year, and I started to get pulled into the broadcast world, which, I mean, you guys know from my writing is not traditionally where I land, but they called me in for that and they're like, what would you do with this show? And I said, I just gave a bunch of ideas, and next thing you know, we were in negotiations. And so it's kind of this totally different experience in the way that it's not really my show. So I'm sort of just coming in and being like, here's what I would do with it. And they've been great about giving me some pretty amazing freedom to not necessarily reboot it, but restart a bunch of character dynamics and change up certain aspects of the show and bring in new characters and whatnot. And it's exciting. You know, I don't watch a lot of broadcast television. But we think about it. It's like, there's like, you know, for this show, there's 8 million viewers on a Friday night of that. That's 16 times the amount of 12 Monkeys, you know, so it's a whole new world. And for me, I was kind of raised on the Paramount lot. When I came out to LA, I was an intern and PA, an assistant on the Star Trek shows. So to be back there and be running a show is meaningful. And they've given me freedom to continue to develop. I'm developing at the same time three sci-fi, not sci-fi channel, but three science fiction projects, one with Disney Plus, one with Quibi, which is a platform you guys will all hear about in the next 6 months.
We've read a lot about that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be made. Oh, you know that one. It's Last American Vampire.
Mm-hmm. It's going forward?
Looks really good. Yeah, it looks very, very good. So,
oh my God, that's so exciting.
Yeah, they love it, and they're like, we're making this, and so we'll see. It's nothing's official yet, but that's still going. And then that's such a fun one. And then there's another one I can't talk about. There's two more I can't really talk about. So there's all this other development stuff going on at the same time.
Wait, so is that four?
Yeah, there's actually there's more than that. There's also an animated project, which I'm hoping is going to be figured out in the next month, an anime. that is super meaningful to me, but we're trying to finish the rights. Netflix is like, we want to make this. And we're like, yay. But there's like kind of a rights issue that they're trying to iron out in Japan. So we will see. Hopefully that goes.
Netflix. Hey, it's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's. So we'll see.
Okay. Wait. So just to follow up, can you tell us anything about the Disney project? Is that the alien sci-fi one?
There are aliens. There's some alien DNA in it. Yes.
Okay. So alien DNA, Disney Plus. I am trying to keep my voice at a regular level about Last American Vampire because I loved it so much. And
oh, that's right. I keep forgetting you guys read the scripts. Yeah,
that's right. That's our next podcast because I loved it.
That would be fun. Yeah, that was that's a blast.
I'll just always remember your description more Liz Lemon than Dana Scully, and it just like that speaks to my
heart. Yeah, I really hope we get to do that one. It was an interesting project because, you know, it's kind of like the CBS thing when MacGyver, they're like, do you want to do, I'm like, I don't know. I'm not really a vampire guy, but I'll do my version of it. And it played out okay. You know, everybody kind of got on board. And so we'll see.
Well, that genre needs a bit of a twist if it's going to hang around.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just want to basically keep track of all of the different music education that he has to go on.
Oh, yes.
Coming back.
yeah, that's right. I love that stuff. Well, that's just an excuse for me to do fun 80s and 90s needle drops. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's all in there. That's so funny.
So all of these franchises, you know, whether it's Avengers Endgame or Game of Thrones or Star Wars, lots of franchises coming to turning points or ends, right? If you could write for one franchise out there and you could just pick, what would it be?
Ooh. It would be a toss up between Star Wars or Star Trek. Mm-hmm. It's difficult because they're such big franchises. So it's not like you can just roll in and be like, I'm taking over. There's a lot of people involved, and I think you have to respect those visions as well. So, I think until then, there's some stuff that hasn't been made too that I would love to do, but I think, we've got to create some new IPs out there, mm-hmm. So we'll see.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking time.
Oh, always. Thank you guys for continuing to do 4 to 5 hour podcasts every week of this show, keeping it alive.
Well, hopefully folks will come on and talk to us because I feel like season 3 is a masterpiece and because of the way it aired, there's not as much out there talking about it. So we'd love to have folks on. I mean, there are some just like masterpiece episodes of television in this season. So
you got to get Todd on to talk about his transformation into prison deacon.
Yeah.
Skinny prison deacon. He worked his ass off for that.
I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Inspiration.
Yeah, maybe I'll go put that on and that'll be my like summer workout inspiration.
Yeah, I know.
It's like it apocalyptic P90X.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, Terry, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Everyone, thank you very much for listening. If you liked this episode, you can find 12 Monkeys Rewatch Pod on Twitter at 12mRewatchPod. You can also find us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, most of the places you can get podcasts. So feel free to rate, review, and subscribe. We really appreciate all you guys. Again, we want to give a special thank you to Terry Metalis, who is always so gracious with his time and so excited to discuss this show that we all know and love. Thank you very much again, Terry. On our next episode, we are discussing 301 Mother, and we have a brand new panelist to introduce to you that we're very excited about. That's coming up in just 1 week, so guess what? We'll see you soon.